Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of the QuietMark podcast. I'm your host, Simon Gosling, CMO at QuietMark. As regular listeners to the show will know, QuietMark is the independent international approval award program associated with the UK Noise Abatement Society Charitable Foundation. It encourages companies worldwide to prioritise noise reduction within the design of everyday machines and appliances and to find solutions to noise problems to benefit health and well-being. A wave of silence has spread across the planet as man-made noise has fallen by 50% during the worldwide coronavirus lockdown. But does a return to a new normality necessarily have to bring with it a rise to pre-lockdown volumes? Three of the biggest causes of noise pollution are air travel, road traffic, and construction. And just as Zoom video conferencing hasn't stopped the QuietMark podcast from taking place, this video conferencing technology has certainly reduced the need for much business air travel and can be reflected in the figures which show that in the UK, there were 650,000 users of Zoom in January and that had gone up to 13 million users by April. Noise pollution from road traffic can also hopefully stay at lower levels with more people deciding to work from home rather than do their daily commute. But what about the noise from construction? Before lockdown, in 2018, the World Health Organization calculated that at least 1 million healthy life years are lost every year in Western European countries because of environmental noise, with cardiovascular disease contributing to the vast majority of these deaths, especially high blood pressure, heart attacks, and coronary heart disease. It is thought that noise triggers the release of the stress hormone cortisol, which damages blood vessels over time. Despite legislation governing noise levels in many countries around the world, the UK's Noise Abatement Act, for example, is 60 years old this year, pre-COVID-19, city centre sound levels still regularly exceeded 65 decibels in many parts of Europe, which is way above the World Health Organization's recommendations. And according to a recent European Environment Agency study, 20% of the EU population, that's around 83 million people, live in areas where sound pressure levels are well above recommended levels. In the UK, there were more than 500,000 noise complaints to councils in 2017. Councils received more complaints about noise than any other issue, and Kensington and Chelsea in London received the most. It had 13,790 complaints in 2016, which is the equivalent of more than 87 complaints for every 1,000 inhabitants. In February this year, 2020, headlines in the news stated that UK house builders had missed government targets of 300,000 new homes a year, despite more new homes being built, saying that the number of new homes registered to be built per annum in the UK has risen by more than 80% over the last decade. So the government has set quite ambitious new housing target levels, and with that increase in construction will inevitably come an increase in noise. But when we look at the noise of construction itself, we know that groundworking is very messy and noisy, and the noise of cement trucks travelling in and off site is also very noisy. But could much of that groundworking noise be done in a factory elsewhere, away from neighbourhoods? And when it comes to the houses themselves that are being built, we know, as we've heard from our various acoustician expert guests on the show, that good acoustics are good for people's well-being. But one wonders how much attention to good acoustic architectural design is being put into the new housing which is being built. To discuss and explore this topic further, my guest on this episode is Mike Jacob, co-founder of Kiss House. Mark Shaler, the founding partner of the Do Lectures, once described Mike as someone who breathes life into the undoable. And by the time you finish listening to this podcast, I'm sure you'll appreciate why. Together, building and construction are responsible for 39% of all carbon emissions in the world. And as a father of young children, Mike is determined to change that. But you can't do that alone, and that's something we're going to look at on today's programme. Mike Jacob graduated in philosophy, but found his true vocation after taking the pioneering MSc in Sustainable Architecture at the Centre for Alternate Technologies, CAT. This set him on a quest to figure out the best way to deliver exceptional buildings through his own business, Trunk. Along the way, Mike's projects have picked up numerous awards. He's a chartered construction manager, certified passive house tradesperson, a past Constructing Excellence Achiever of the Year, and one of Building Magazine's 50 Rising Stars of Sustainability. He's brought that experience to Kiss House, along with an unshakable belief that there's a better way to build a home where quality and comfort are everything. Mike leads everything product related at Kiss House. He's responsible for interrogating every aspect of the design and performance and for quality. He's also the originator of their innovative foundation system. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hello, Simon. It's very nice to be here. Thank you very much.
It's lovely to be speaking to you on this hot summer's day in August. Whereabouts are we talking to you from? I know we're on video conference, so where are you?
I'm in the area of Berkshire that sits between the really posh bit of Reading, Caversham Heights, and the really normal bit of Reading. I'm in central Caversham by the River Thames, in a lovely little pocket of the country that's sort of often overlooked and often ridiculed, but it's great here. It really is.
Ah, sounds idyllic. And we read in the bio there that you graduated in philosophy and made all the way through to founding your own company, Kiss House. In a succinct way, tell us a bit more about that journey, if you wouldn't mind.
I know the succinct prompt. I will be as succinct as I possibly can, but it's a kind of interesting one.
Go for it.
So I'm a kind of somebody who, I'm a generalist. And I've always been a generalist, and I used to think that was like a bad thing until later on in life you realise actually that's a really quite a good thing to be a generalist. And so I did a philosophy degree because I actually realised I didn't like the subjects that I'd gone to university to study, which was linguistics. And I only went to university to study that because of basically an arbitrary decision that I made, having done an English language and not really thinking about it at all. The point is, it didn't really matter to me, and it's never really mattered to me at all. I didn't make specific choices at school or for A-levels. I've always genuinely felt that there was another sort of more important thing in life, which is on two levels. One, just living and not making arbitrary decisions about things that are put in front of you and you sort of choose X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. There's actually just living and enjoying life. And then I always had this belief. I could never really explain it. I never said it out loud because I had the kind of, Yorkshire people around me that would say, well, that's a load of rubbish. But I always had a feeling that there was something that was just, there was an important thing up ahead that if I just didn't worry about it and just live life, it would work out. So I was driven by that, just driven by trying to be authentic. And philosophy was a brilliant degree. It was 4 hours a week. And so it gave me a lot of time to just live as well. And it was quite good just in terms of becoming a human being, a rounded, interested human being. And kind of a Kiss House business is a result of having been a generalist who's just always really cared about what it is to be alive, what it is to really be alive in this world. It's kind of underpinning a lot of the values of the business. And so as succinct as I can be for now, I think, whether it's enough of a reasonable answer, I should wait for your response and see what you...
No, you managed to complete that before it went... I think you did very well. But what we didn't say was that midway between that journey, there was involvement with Passive House. For the listeners, tell us, what is Passive House and what did it teach you?
I'll probably go back a step first then to make a bit more sense. So having done a philosophy degree, I thought for a while that I could earn some money playing the drums because when I wasn't doing 4 hours a week of lectures, I was playing a lot of drums.
I'm a drummer too. So so you were playing the drums.
Okay. I was amongst the majority of drummers who can't make a living doing it. And I just somehow, I think because I was in that section of unconventional people who in Reading, like you go and work at the Prudential, really, most people go and do that. But if you don't work at the Prudential, then you do interesting stuff. You do random interesting stuff. And I was in that sort of bunch of people. And so there would occasionally these like interesting projects would float past me. And I was the sort of person who was happy to say, yeah, I'll do that. Or I'll look after that. And I just kind of, these projects were related to building stuff or making stuff. And it involved these sorts of creative types of people. And because I was somebody who people seemed to, I can rely on you, I can trust you, and you'll say yes. I ended up becoming, by accident, a sort of project manager of creative, interesting construction projects. And by an organic process. And it sort of lasted for about 10 years. I'd done just some fascinating stuff I'd be really proud of. It was a really great time. But over that period of time, I just kept thinking there's got to be a better way than this, because like all around me, I just saw compromise and I saw things like, well, we'll just put a bit of plasterboard over that and a bit of mastic and no one will know. And there was a culture of not really caring. And whilst there was this creative interest and fulfillment in the projects, there was a lack of substance and quality that I just kept seeing all the time. I said that there's got to be a better way. And I think that belief, that feeling there has to be a better way links into the childhood's weird self-confidence of something ahead will be all right and figure out.
That's okay. Nice.
And this better way was like, eventually, my wife discovered this world that was very well established, that existed, that related to sustainable architecture and passive house and low-energy building. And I had this epiphany. I was like, right, that is the better way. I've got to get into that. I've got to become professionally accredited. I've got to become qualified. I want to get into it. That turns me on. It was an instinctive, that's my role. That's what I've got to do. I've got to get in that world. But okay. I didn't want to be an architect. Right. I didn't want to be an engineer. I didn't know what I wanted to do, really. I just wanted to be involved and ingratiate myself in this really exciting world. So that's not the most easy entry point when you have a sort of, you know, very broad, instinctive desire to be involved, but you can't tell anyone what it is you actually want to do.
Yeah.
But I think also that comes back to the generalist thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and I can be very specific about how that has really been the driving force behind Kisshouse. Because the industry consists of silos. Typically, it consists of professional disciplines who are narrow and often hide behind emails because they, you know, often there's a culture of claims and all the rest of it. And so coming into this new world, thinking I'm interested in all of it, really, you know, and let's just get stuck in. So the first thing I did was the MSc in Sustainable Architecture at CAT.
Right.
The Centre for Alternative, which was like a really, it was almost like this golden era because there was a rebellious course leader who was like a sort of maverick punk character that was from the University of East London. He probably drove them mad, but he was a brilliant inspirational course leader. It was a special time, you know, it really was. You felt like you were this sort of this moment in history when people were buzzing off him and everything that they were learning, and the course was residential, so it was at the Centre for Alternative Technology, which is a lovely, crazy place.
What was his name, Mike?
He's called Mike Thompson. He was just a very cool guy. And it was also, luckily, at a time when the construction industry and the economy was, like, it felt like it was all of a sudden going to get really, really good. So, you know, optimistic, aspirational standards were coming in. Vast amounts of money was being aimed at making, like, housing. Stand building regulations, schools, the lot, making it all as good as it could possibly be.
What year are we in here?
It was pre-crash. It was in the run-up to the credit crunch. It was during the time that things like zero carbon was invented as a standard, and the code for sustainable homes came in.
I see.
As something that people, and it was from about 2006 onwards, you know, when there was the beginnings of the incremental tightening of the building regs and the roadmap towards 2016.
Okay.
Which was when every single house is going to be built to the zero carbon standard from 2016 onwards. And of course, that hasn't happened. And of course, over that period of time, the definition of zero carbon got diluted and diluted and diluted. But it was a really interesting time. And that was when I got into the industry, did the master's, was a sort of a proactive individual, found a local startup business in Reading that was a very well-funded startup looking to be the first passive house developer in the UK. And to kind of get to your question about passive house, there's a sort of simplicity about the passive house standard that really, really appealed to me. And I can remember the moment when I sort of discovered it and felt the drawn towards it. And it was just seeing a section through a wall of a house designed to the passive house standard, and just noticing how neat and continuous the layer of insulation was around the structure.
Right.
And I thought, and how much of it there was. And I was like, wow. And the note underneath said, you know, this building requires virtually no heating and remains comfortable throughout the year. And I just thought, that's elegant and simple and beautiful. And I'm really drawn towards that. That's quality. There's a conceptual idealism about that really appealed to the philosopher in me. And so I got into passive house. It's a standard that's quite complex. It's German, but I got into it and discovered that there's this divide between people who are motivated to deliver the best possible building fabric and the people who are drawn towards technology to solve energy related issues. And I was definitely in the building fabric crowd or tribe, and I've remained there ever since. So it's like a fabric first approach, which is what passive house is.
I liked that sentence, Mike, if you don't mind me cutting in there, just so that you said you read a sentence and this building retains heat and is comfortable to live in. Talk about passive house's motto in a nutshell. That really does sum it up. And because we are the Quiet Mark podcast. I'm curious to know, did acoustics come into this ideal that the Passive House was trying to create?
Well, it's a question that I'm very mindful not to appear to be selling Kiss House, but if I can use it as a reference point to sort of give added context to this question. The Passive House standard was developed by two physicists, and they were the really often told like little anecdote is they read something in a newspaper that said builders are putting more insulation in buildings, but they're not, the heating costs aren't going down. And they were offended by that on the level of like first principles, that simply something's going wrong there. What is it? So they developed a standard to make it easy for people to put more insulation into buildings and do other things too, and actually reduce the energy costs because of climate change. But it became known as the comfort standard because they were equally concerned. This was driven by carbon emissions, but they were equally concerned with the comfort of the occupants living in these buildings. And that principally relates to thermal comfort as far as Passive House is concerned. And there's a very strict line in the sand in terms of overheating. So when you're designing your Passive House, you've got to make sure, and you check this at the design stage, that it will not exceed this overheating limit. But there's no requirement for acoustic performance other than sort of implicit within the specification of some of the ventilation equipment. They're virtually silent in operation. But by sort of accident or by default, the detailing and the triple glazing and the thick walls and all that stuff means that you've got very, very quiet internal environments. But it's not a requirement of the standards to hit any particular line in the sand. And so the reason for kind of pre-excusing mentioning Kiss House is that whilst a Passive House will give you a tremendous degree of separation from the outside world and make it very quiet inside, there's no consideration given beyond that to the separation between rooms or floors within buildings. And this is what we think is really, really important in terms of actual comfort, well-being, the experience of living in a house where things just make you feel really at ease as a human being, and as you should feel, not how we typically feel because of our off-kilter lives.
So the outer shell is keeping sound out from its well-insulated perspective, but it's internally where you think the magic can also happen in the way that the rooms inside that shell are separated. And again, because of our interest in acoustics, does that sound separation, those walls, doors, floors, are they acoustically driven as well as visually, aesthetically when it comes to something like Kiss House?
It's fundamental, you know, a Kiss House is not about the design of the house that you see on the website. You know, it's not about the type of flooring that you've got. It's about a whole host of things that are principles and a system and a philosophy that are, you know, go together to create something that's much greater than the sum of its parts. And acoustic separation for reasons of privacy and just making you feel relaxed, because, you know, whether it's being able to watch a film late at night and know that you're not disturbing anybody or other things, you know, of a personal nature, whatever it may be, you're just always comfortable because you know there's this solid privacy built in, and that's not required by the building regs. It's very variable. It's entirely variable. And you find lots of evidence of very expensive housing developments. You go in with an estate agent to walk around and you're kind of like in this hollow sounding, no consideration given it to whatsoever. But it's fine because it passes the statutory requirements. And actually, the estate agent's doing a great job of selling it. And the people don't even really think about it. They don't know what good is because everything's bad. That's the irony of this whole situation, is that nobody knows. It's a great big illusion that the quality of the living experience that most people have could be a whole lot better, but nobody realizes it. So they accept it as normal. And normal is not good enough.
Wow.
Normal is resulting in people having poor quality existences without even realizing it. It's crazy. So this is why acoustic going above and beyond, which is not difficult, it's not expensive, it's just taking a little bit more time and care, is vital from our perspective. So yeah, we definitely do that for that reason. Because, you know, making people's living experience or elevating it, you know, what's more important than that, really? You know, what is more important than helping people live their best lives and be their best selves? And this is kind of the thing that I reckon I've always been pursuing, this really important thing. For me, that's now if this feels like important work, you know, we're doing work which matters to us, because we know that the things that we're trying to do at Kiss House are ultimately going to make people feel happy or feel better or feel more relaxed, and that's kind of worthwhile and motivating, and it's an exciting place to be.
Well, from your generalist beginnings
to a path that's taken you through sustainable architecture degree, and also you've been recognised as Construction Excellence Achiever of the Year and one of Building Magazine 50 Rising Stars of Sustainability, it's really been your passion that's driven you to where you are now. So in terms of Kiss House, let's look at Kiss House a bit closer. Looking at your website, I see a selection of beautiful spaces, but rather than me describe them, tell us about the aesthetic of them and what a Kiss House is.
Well, actually, the fact of the matter is that a Kiss House could look like anything, really. It could be, and I'll qualify that in a moment because that's quite a misleading comment. It could look radically different from the ones that you currently see on the website. It could be designed by a different architect, could be a different form, you know, pitched roofs and all the rest of it, townhouses, terraces. This is the beginning. This is the starting point. And the important thing is to think that, well, we're not setting out to make design in itself the most important thing. It should be very important, and it should be design-led, and it should be elegant, it should be modernist, it should be simple, it should be pure in all of those things. And light and space should, you know, we should worship at the altar of light and space when it comes to, you know, the internal environment. And all of that stuff really is important. Mm-hmm. And we have a set of principles and a kind of design guides that underpin this current range of houses that we're marketing, but there is a new range coming through and it will continue to expand and evolve. Fundamentally modernist in terms of aesthetic, natural materials and lots of light and space and well-organized, adaptable interiors, and this is key, is the kind of utility aspects. Well, you know, there's a lot of needs that people don't even know that they have, which we are trying to anticipate when it comes to things like storage and how we are going to deal with cooking and food storage and spaces for doing things like washing and all of this stuff. We want to make it a product that is going to anticipate needs that people didn't really know they had in the simplest, most elegant way, so that it's kind of not even really noticed. And that's kind of what the Kiss House aesthetic and philosophy is really trying to achieve, more than saying, look at this amazing, beautiful house.
Right.
Because that's missing the point. And neither are we saying, oh, guess what? You can, it's just like buying a car now. You can go on a computer and choose your colour of your cladding and all the rest. Missing the point as well. What we're trying to say is, live in this house, you will feel the best you could possibly feel. We're going to give you your best life because you're going to feel amazing. And that's really the point. Everything else is pared back. It's simple. It's invisible. You don't want to be overwhelmed with choice, even if you think you do. Actually, you don't, and we know that because we spent years. The intervening period between Kiss House and doing the CAT Masters was, you know, I spent a decade delivering high-end, bespoke, low-energy projects that very often were kind of coming off the rails at the beginning because of various known inherent problems within the industry about disconnections between cost analysis and energy performance analysis at the early stages. There's a tremendous amount of lessons that were learned over that decade in bespoke, complex, high-end projects, and that is where you learn lessons. And this Kiss House is a vehicle to transfer those lessons out to a wider audience and say, like, okay. Otherwise, the knowledge gained is lost if you just keep doing another complex project after another. And I personally was very motivated to try and leverage that intellectual property or those lessons, to try and harness the power of those lessons to really make them have an impact or benefit more people.
So you're not just changing the world of housing or the industry of building one house at a time. You're creating IP which can be taken on by the industry and therefore change the world of building to be a more sustainable practice.
Well, I mean, this is what's happened over the last 18 months. We have. I mean, anyone listening to this, if they are looking at our website, it only tells half the story at the moment. And that's because when it was designed, it couldn't do anything else. But what's happened, and we're playing catch up now, is that the business has evolved over the last year or so because of this approach to genuinely wanting things to be the best that they can be. And a restless interrogation of every detail, because like the acoustic separation, well, what separating layer are we going to use, and what damper do we need dampers here? Well, we've got to think about it. And this duct, if that's compressed at that point, it's going to have a noise turbulence. You've got to think about every single screw, every single. We want to be open to any level of interrogation. It dawned on me that also having a generalist horizontal attitude to this industry is beneficial, because then it means come up against someone who says, well, no, we've always done it like that. So why would we change it? And I'm saying, because it's not good enough, actually. Brilliant. And because we need to work harder to make this better. And that was a process that was really just driven by the conviction that we have to do that in order to make the houses make people feel or live their best lives. We have to go through this. It's like the iPod was painted on the inside. They coated the inside where you would never know, but they did that because they speculated that people would just sense somehow that it had this extra level of care put into it. And so we've got that innate desire. And yes, that led to, so we've thought really, really hard about trying to solve this problem for us. And actually that could benefit. Well, there's a thing that other people could benefit from as well. So it really just very innocently evolved into this machine, really. That the Kiss House process generates IP products with potential to improve other houses. It's not a money-making venture. It's what can we do to make things better? And if it can make many other houses better too, then what we need to do, actually, what we must do, and what we're being told to do by the World Green Building Council, is collaborate in a radically new way with the sorts of partners that have the resources to commercialize these sorts of things to actually make a difference, because it's a climate crisis situation right now, and embodied carbon is the big issue. So
what does the World Green Building Council say here? What sort of instruction do they give to the building industry?
They are very influential. They released a very influential report, very big report came out called Bringing Embodied Carbon Upfront. And it's saying for years now, building regs have got tighter, buildings are insulated better. So operational carbon in use, that's sort of okay. You know, the embodied carbon, the elephant in the room, the energy, the embodied energy that's resulted in creating the materials used to build buildings is very significant. It's actually 39% of CO2 emissions globally is from the construction industry. And a large proportion of that is embodied carbon. So that it's the big headline issue in the industry. And the construction industry is known as being the least innovative of all industries, as well as being the biggest. So there's a big kind of tension there.
And so your IP is addressing that.
Well, yeah. So this is the thing. I mean, we're driven by natural materials, okay? Mm-hmm. For reasons of comfort, for reasons of sustainability, and it's the right thing to do. But if you think about it, what human beings have unwittingly done over the generations is created environments within which to sort of survive on this planet, but by using all the wrong stuff. We've ended up, unfortunately, using a lot of concrete and steel and oil-based materials to inhabit the planet, and this is the issue. And so the transition towards low embodied carbon alternatives is what the World Green Building Council is basically saying. Sort it out. Industry, change what you do. Collaborate radically. Innovate. Every single stakeholder, whoever you are, you need to assume a leadership role. And we've got to make change. We've got to do it urgently. We've got to do it now. That's what they're saying. That's not what that report's saying. And I'm thinking to myself when I read it, crikey, that's what we're already doing, but we're a tiny little startup company. And yet we've developed new materials which actually, independently when assessed, could have a transformational effect on this very issue on embodied carbon. So what we need to do, of course, is find the partners with whom to collaborate to develop the proof of concept, to industrialize and scale up these things. And of course, that's, on the one hand, that's not, hang on, I thought we were doing houses. You know, I thought this was a turnkey housing business. Well, no. This is about making things as good as they can be. It's about making lives better. And so if Kiss House is all about a way of thinking, and if that way of thinking is resulting in solutions that can make all houses better, that could make all houses result in lives being better as a radically different society that would emerge from that. And in fact, when you look at the sorts of companies that have got the resources to make these things happen, mm-hmm. they've got the same values. All it requires is for very few dots to be joined up. And so that's what we believe we're positioning ourselves as, that small leading edge leadership role assuming innovator who requires the support from the big guys to transform a sector. And that's what we've become credible now with patent applications and independent assessments of the potential for the potential impact of our materials. And it's a perpetual thing. So we will continually look at Kiss House. They will be built and sold, but only in low volume, you see. So we know now, we can confidently say we're going to cap the volume of this thing, because that's the only way we can think properly about it.
You described yourself just then as just a startup, and you said you need the support of the big guys in order to achieve your goals. Well, talking of the big guys, a recent signing to your team has come from a rather big place. Tell us about that.
I had to, for a while, keep this quiet, but we are thrilled. Overwhelmed, actually, almost, it's quite impossible to comprehend, but the current vice chairman of Deloitte, which is basically the top guy in Europe, is going to join us and become our financial director in a short period of time when he retires. Of course, that lends credibility at a really rather high level, a high level of credibility for us when we're emerging from, we thought you were a boutique little lifestyle business. No, we're not. We're an innovator pioneering new products. We need a different caliber of, or we need a new caliber or an appropriate caliber of person to join the company. And he's not the only one who's coming in from us at a senior level, and we're actually in quite detailed discussions with precisely the sorts of multinational partners that I'm saying are necessary to make these things happen. So we're just going for it, because why not? You know, we believe we can make a difference, and it's important. So
all
of this has happened very, very serendipitously. It's not what we set out to do. It's just happened because we just make decisions based on gut feel. Is this right? Is this wrong? An easy way to go through life, really, you know, deciding things like that.
No, I can relate. You're on a mission to transform housing for the better. And Quiet Mark, we're on a mission to make the world sound better. Whether that's certifying appliances and materials which are quieter than the majority on the market, that are amongst the quietest, or whether it's our Acoustics Academy, which recognises materials which enable housing and buildings of all types to be improved acoustically. Because we know, and stuff we've discussed on this programme, is that through improved acoustics, whether it's in a school, you'll see better attendance, better well-being, better results. There was a school that was talked about in episode 4, Swain Park School, which was treated by Ecofon, and it achieved Ofsted's outstanding status post-acoustic treatment because, well, it was just a better space for everyone, a more inclusive space for everyone. Yeah. But one of the things I know that you and I have talked about is the going into one of the houses that you've created, people have, you know, almost on a 100% basis said, wow, this place feels right. They say it walking through the door, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm careful, and it's the same with every house I've ever built, passive to the Passive House standard or Passive House certified, that you close the door, there's a moment, and it's subtle. You can't oversell it. Other people are like, well, what was that? But it's a subtle thing that is just about calm, peace, at ease, something that's just nurturing and almost like this is a sanctuary space. And it's that, and you get it a split second after you close the front door when you walk in. And I've, without exception, that's been my experience of taking people in any building to that standard, is that that's what you get. And you know what I've realised? You only have to do a few simple things really well to achieve that. It's not hard. It is not hard, but most people don't bother, or they don't understand it. And it seems to me to be a crazy situation that if, let's say, you could radically transform society at a global level because people just felt a lot better by doing a few simple things really well, why wouldn't you? We live in a crazy world, and that's the answer, is because we live in a crazy world. But you know, we want to try and just assume this leadership role, you know, that the call to action from the Green Building Council is to do that. Well, hang on, if we've spent decades realizing it's all actually dead simple, then why not just get on and do that and shout about it and try to have as much impact as possible? And the report, I'd only seen the McKinsey report post-COVID, is saying disruption is the new normal in construction. It's going to be, at least, is a radical transformation to the construction sector, because it is the poorest performing, worst offending, least innovating, biggest industry on the planet. And there you go. There's a need, isn't there?
Absolutely, there is.
And so I think, you know, just a thought before I forget, there's shut the door, oh, it's really peaceful, it makes you feel good. But the flip side to that is, and like, you know, there are sounds that we kind of, we need sound to a degree. We need some sounds and we need them to be as high quality as possible. And that might relate to nature, might relate to hearing the birds singing. It might relate to, you know, as you are no doubt aware, the sound sculptures that are being introduced into shopping centres, the very subtle background noise of waterfalls and things like that. It's just as important as an absence of sound, I think. So it's a fascinating subject. It really is. And like that kind of emotional level, this level of sort of indefinable feelings that we have in situations. That's what this is about. This is not about making a washing machine quiet.
No.
This is, what you're doing is really inspiring. Your mission is the same as ours, I think. It's about making living better.
Indeed.
By focusing on quality.
It's interesting what you're saying there, because one of the guests on the show as well was a chap called Martin Rawlins, who's from Baswa. And one of the things he was keen to impress, obviously Baswa's ceilings are in the Louvre Museum and the V&A memberships bar and the Apple Store in New York. And he said, Simon, understand it's not about soundproofing. He said, because you'll always hear the planes outside and the birds singing. He said, and actually you don't always want to lose that. It's not about soundproofing. It's about sound improvement. And that's something else he said. He said that the phrase that people say when they go into a space which has got a Baswa ceiling in it is, this space feels right. And this is the acoustic treatment that we're seeing in schools, we're seeing in domestic homes. And actually, with Kiss House, can I ask, is it about domestic homes or do you create office structures as well?
Currently, we're focusing on residential solutions, but who knows? I mean, it's my ambition before I got made redundant in the sort of credit crunch was to get into passive house schools and creating a reputable passive house school model, primary schools in particular.
Interesting.
That didn't happen because of the recession. So my interest is in any building that is inhabited to be as good as it can be. But a Kiss House is kind of like the house. The clue's in the name of our houses at the moment. But who knows?
But I suppose the IP that you're creating and the products you're creating can be used in the development of all types of building, not just residential.
Well, that's the story. That you're right. You're right to pick up on that because clearly, you know, if someone was to place an order for our product to put into their commercial building, then we'd be delighted.
Tell me, Mike, is Kiss House part of this new wave of off-site manufactured houses?
Yeah, I guess you could say that, but we're ploughing our own furrow. It's not about those things that are sort of current drivers for, you know, strong business cases that you can see evidence all around of, you know, big money being put into house building factories. Overseas investors, Japan's biggest house builder is done a partner with Urban Splash and Homes England. Legal & General have set out to become Britain's biggest house builder with an enormous factory in the north of England. Top Hat have had 80 million put into them from Goldman Sachs. And this is the reality of the industry right now, is that off-site manufacturing is the circus in town. It's the thing that everyone's saying is going to be the solution to the housing crisis. And I'm really not a cynical person at all. I don't wish to sound in any way cynical, but the trouble is when your business model is about selling as many houses as you possibly can, you have shareholder priorities at the top of your list, and therefore profit maximization, cost minimization is ultimately going to be the things that drive those businesses. And so not only do we not wish to take the risk of owning a factory, we don't want to get into the race to the bottom because we'll lose our edge. We'll lose the very magic thing, the magical thing that we discovered that creates these new ideas. And so being an ideas factory means we have to be low volume. Being low volume doesn't justify having a factory. But then what do you do? Do you find a manufacturing partner to do it for you? Well, then you're just a website, aren't you, really? And that's kind of, for people like me who spent whole life working through actually really doing stuff, it would be a bit dispiriting to get to this mid-career sweet spot and just have a website and a manufacturing partner that does all the stuff that you really want to be doing. The thing is, when we spent about 2 years going around looking for potential manufacturing partners, not just in this country either, there are several like really cracking Lithuanian or Estonian or wherever, some really amazing companies out there that we could have contracted with. But again, do they share the same values as us? Are we able to stand over them and make sure they're doing it exactly the way we want? Are they actually principally concerned themselves about maximum volume. And there's always that risk, isn't there, that you end up in a contractual relationship with a third party who's got a commercial objective that's fundamentally different from yours.
Right.
And so we had to make the decision, well, God, we're making this hard for ourselves. You know, that's not going to work either. We got into this position that we're in now, which is fortunately because there are other like-minded people in this industry. There are kindred spirits. You know, there are people trying to do good stuff, in other words, so some of whom I have known for a long time, that we're able to help each other. It's like Star Wars. It's, you know, you've got the dark side. And then you've got the good guys. You've got the good guys, and there's enough good guys out there to collaborate. And so collaboration is, again, this is one of these things. It's a buzzword. It's something that everyone's told to do. In fact, the industry's been told to do it since the 1930s, and it still isn't really doing it. But there's collaboration that you're told to do, and there's collaboration that you want to do. And the two are quite different things. And one of them is real and authentic and actually and results in good outcomes. And the other is just like, oh, I've got to do this, so I'm supposed to not sue you and all the rest of it. We've ended up with a very appropriate, low risk. For the last couple of years, we've been in this position where we know that we can partner with a manufacturer who's willing to collaborate with us on developing the first few kiss houses that we get out there, so we do it right. We're hands-on involved in the manufacturing process, and it's a stepping stone towards us having our center of excellence, which is the ambition. It's part of the vision. Is a kiss house ultimately lands from space. You don't know where it's made, just lands from space. But really, it's made in our center of excellence, which is what we would call our factory, which is the place that we would be making in low numbers our houses in the way that we want to, so that we can come up with new ideas. So it's an innovation center. It's not space age. It's not costing £200 million somewhere. It's a simple space that people like going to because it's impressive and it's interesting. Interesting enough, we have developed, again, because I tend to think, well, we've got to just try and work with the best people, have the biggest ideas, do the best things, and see what happens. And very often you thought, hit a brick wall. But if you keep going like that, you know, sometimes you don't hit the brick wall. Mm. We've agreed this week to have a collaborative relationship with a different sort of partner, a company called Bryden Woods. Bryden Woods are a global multidisciplinary consultancy at the absolute cutting edge of offsite manufacturing, design for manufacturing and assembly, all of the latest digital technologies for the way that not housing, but the entire construction economy is going to sector is going to change. Mm-hmm. They've developed a system with the government to underpin the £800 billion worth of government spending that's been committed to systemized, offsite, innovative new methods of construction. Bryden Woods are kind of like the leaders in the field. And it turns out that the two guys that founded the company were sort of like, well, we sort of think the same, really. And your little tiny little kiss house thing, that's really interesting. We like that. And so if you're creating the world's best housing products, which is our ambition, and we need a partner who's appropriately qualified to do that with. And it turns out that 25 years ago, one of the co-founders had this ambition to have a center of excellence himself, which he's never realized. And so now I'm pursuing a couple of grant funding opportunities to create the Kiss House Bryden Woods Center of Excellence, where the world's best housing products will be created. And this is just going right back to the beginning. Like, ideas to words to things is a ridiculously simple process, but that's how stuff happens. And yeah. So it means that we will be making it ourselves, but we will be doing it in an agile, intelligent, low-tech and simple way. There's no need for massive automation and huge like investment because, frankly, those factories are not making any houses at the moment. There's another, unfortunately, you know, another potentially a bubble, either a bubble waiting to burst or just the same low-quality houses that are currently made in fields being made in a factory and then delivered to a field, you know, and just mainstream housing for you. So that's kind of a rounded answer to the question, I think. What was the question? Do we make them ourselves?
Yes.
Sort of.
Sort of. But no, but if you're not, but you're partnering with kindred spirits to do so, and that's key.
But ultimately, we're developing a system that will be delivered through a network of licensed partners. That's the long-term objective.
Of course.
But for now, we do it hands-on ourselves with partners that we've known.
Something I'd like to know, Mike, is you mentioned the World Green Building Council and certain regulations. Are they the law or are they recommendations when it comes from the World Green Building Council and the building industry?
I mean, the only legal requirement is building regulations and planning conditions. The World Green Building Council is a sort of consortium of, you know, multinational companies and organisations that all think the same thing and are basically campaigning, getting the messages out there. And, you know, that's important, but there's no requirement for anyone to pay any attention to what they're saying, you know, which is the sad thing.
Yes, because you said there was a 2016 goal that had been missed. Who set the 2016 goal?
It was the Labour government. It was John Prescott. It was incredibly ambitious and exciting. And zero carbon was an ambitious target from day one, and it was pretty much like it was what it said on the tin. And then the house building industry starts lobbying the government, and then the standard gets redefined, and it gets redefined, and all of a sudden zero carbon doesn't mean anything really remotely like it meant at the beginning. And then you get to 2016, and it's like, okay, let's just sort of bum shuffle along to 2017 and not enforce this. And it wasn't enforced because it was decided that it was too hard to expect the industry to do that. And in fact, you know, that's actually because house builders would feel it in their profit margins. And so they have the influence to achieve those outcomes. And that's the reality of the situation. It's not hard at all to build houses properly. It's just that it costs a little bit more money and it's a bit more hassle. And why would we want to do that? Because we've got shareholders to satisfy. That's just the truth of the situation. But there is a change coming. There are small pockets of hope, and there's sort of like the custom builds, or the Right to Build Acts has sort of opened up an emerging sector of, the theory is there will become affordable building plots and companies like us that you can choose to have a house from to make self-build easier. So that's quite interesting. But there's also, I think, because I've been told, some very, very disruptive, very large regeneration companies who are just going to disrupt the housing market, but they're not. They're going to take 5 to 10 years to do that because they're going to do it properly. And so that's being spoken about behind closed doors. I don't know if it's true or not. It would be great if it was. It would be great if we were a small part of that in some way. The Kiss House, a desirable, must have tiny little part of a big project because it brings some element of kudos and quality. That's sort of where I would see ourselves in that world, not making thousands of houses. That's that whole margin. But certainly the custom build space, partnering with motivated landowners who actually, this is a seam of people out there who want to make a difference. They want to leave something behind. So they think they've helped a little bit. And some of these people, they own a bit of land and they're motivated to create some better quality houses. And it might be 10, 20, whatever. But that's a target market for us to perform small joint ventures with people like that. And then we're showing, and the showing how it can be done results in influence as well as the product creation. It's sort of the influential, intangible factor that we'd like to have as well, rather than go out there and say we're going to become the next Taylor Wimpey, which should clearly be stupid. It's the low volume, I think, is where we can achieve the best results. We've always wanted for you to walk through the door, and it just feels like you're inside a piece of fitted furniture. Everything's unified. Everything's just like, oh, wow, actually, I'm inside a Kiss House now. I can tell this. I'm inside a piece of beautiful fitted furniture. And it's recognisable. We've got our own kitchen, our own modular furniture, modular shelving systems. Nothing touches the floor because it all hangs from a wall lining system. It's stuff that's been given a lot of thought that relates to utility as much as aesthetics and simplicity. And here comes a screaming child. You're going to have to pause, I think.
Mike, it's been fantastic enjoying this conversation with you. I've personally learned a lot. It's great to know what you are doing and your journey to a Kiss House and your plans for the future. I wish you very well with them. But before I sign off, you said you're a drummer, and of course I'm a drummer. I'm not going to let that go. Where did you get with your drumming? Did you get anywhere near being the next Ringo Starr?
I made the commitment to Sofa Surf and Transit Van around the country and all that stuff. I did that for a number of years because it was all or nothing. You know, I really felt driven. I just felt like it was it was what I wanted to do. So you just went with it. Now we got, goodness me, what did we do? I played in a number of bands. Uh-huh. It was not all drum. It's not sat behind the drum kit. There was a lot of percussion involved. I was fascinated with Brazilian percussion and West African in particular. I spent time in Ghana studying ritual drumming. I played drum kit in a band where we got as far as touring, and we were with one of Radiohead's people that were getting us plugged in. We plugged into this kind of like beginner's circuit of gigs that ultimately just fizzled out. Mm-hmm. But we did some great music, really lovely music, just the wrong time. We played Glastonbury with another band. We opened at Annie Nightingale's opening party for Glastonbury, which was great fun.
Very impressed.
But that was with an all percussion group. One of the other members of that group is now teaching my 4-year-old daughter at reception in school. It's amazing. Like 15 years down the line, it's funny how these things work out.
Would you say that any of that exploration into, I know there's a lot of people think drummer, it's just crash, bang and loud, but actually being at the back of the band, feeling that rhythm, there's a great sensitivity that goes with drumming. And when you think about albums like Kind of Blue by Miles Davis, jazz drumming in particular isn't crash, bang, wallop. It's very sensitive, it's very delicate, and you have to give space to the other instruments to breathe. I think there's a lot you can learn on a drummer's stool about sound, about communicating with other people, letting their voices be heard, and so on. Would you agree, and do you think in any way that that's informed what you do in creating spaces which let people lead their best lives?
Well, that was the style that I ended up adopting. It was removing notes. It was being subtle. And the band that we toured with, that we thought we were going to make it, deluded as we were at the time, we believed it. The bass player and I, we were locked on, and we were in that less is more category. We were in the, you know, the subtlety, the beauty of creating space rather than trying to fill it. And it's the absolute perfect syncopated moment to just do one thing that's you know, that anchors everything. It's totally, I mean, maybe there's a correlation. I think there's certainly a correlation in terms of following one's intuition, you know, and doing what feels right at the moment, and that's certainly part of the journey. So yeah, I think so.
Well, now it's time for the cymbal crash before we do a sign off. So it's a
underpinned by a subtle little bass drum, and that's got to have,
and maybe some chimes.
Yeah.
It's not. Mike, thanks so much for your time today. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope to see you again soon.
Well, thank you for giving me the time, and more importantly, Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure. It really has. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Mike Jacob there, providing us with plenty of food for thought when it comes to sustainable practices in building and the practice of building homes with the well-being of the occupants truly in mind. Our thanks to him for taking time to speak to us, and our thanks to you for taking time to tune in and listen. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and if you have, I welcome you to enjoy past episodes of the Quiet Mark podcast available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and other podcast platforms. If you're an architect or work in building construction and listening to Mike has inspired you to give greater consideration to acoustics in future buildings, then do feel free to check out our acousticsacademy.com on the quietmark.com website. There you'll find a wide range of acoustically verified products and materials for the building sector. Products such as acoustic ceilings, floors, double and triple glazing, vents, boilers and showers, acoustic murals, and even acoustic furniture. We've got some fantastic guests lined up for future episodes of the Quiet Mark podcast, so stay tuned. Until the next time, take care and goodbye. Bye for now.